Hello, my name is Simon Ward, and I would like to welcome you to the Triathlon Coach podcast. If you don't already know me, I'm the founder of thetriathloncoach.com and the SWAT Inner Circle, and I've been a triathlon coach for over 20 years, working with absolute beginners right up to Olympic champions and covering all distances from sprint to Ironman. Now it's my goal in this weekly 30-minute podcast to share practical, usable advice from the best athletes, coaches and experts from the world of triathlon so that you can get the most from your training time and maximise your enjoyment of the triathlon lifestyle. So as I've already said, we've got just 30 minutes, so let's get rolling with today's guest. Hello everybody, welcome back to the Triathlon Coach SWATcast. I'm Simon Ward, your host, and today's guest is my business partner and elite triathlon coach, Jack Maitland. Welcome to the show, Jack.
Good morning, Simon. Thank you for inviting me on.
Yeah, now you've got coffee there, so we're all good to go.
Yeah, and that's quite essential for my operation.
Mine too. So anyway, for those of you who haven't met Jack before or aren't aware of Jack's backstory, before we get to our starting point today, Jack was, I would call him a full-time athlete because you were operating in the area before, I guess, professional triathletes, Jack. So you went from being a full-time mountain runner to professional full-time triathlete, and then you jumped into coaching after that, and you were involved in the High Performance Centre in Leeds, and you worked there for, what, 10, 12 years?
More than that, actually. So I was actually doing the performance work altogether for 16 years.
16 years, and you finished there recently, so you're just about to take a new direction in your coaching career. But let's go backwards, right back to the very beginning. So I talked about mountain running or fell running, as we know it in this country. So tell us about your early days in sport for a start.
Yeah, okay. So my early days in sport, I was brought up in a small village in the northeast of Scotland, and had some fairly influential PE teachers there who took us a little bit outside of the normal box of just playing football and badminton or whatever. And my first sport where I really travelled outside the environs of Aberdeenshire was orienteering. And I kind of fell into that in a rather strange way. But anyway, between my two PE teachers, they got me really enthused by orienteering and the sort of running that went alongside that. Started doing a bit of running training with one of my teachers and sort of joined the Scottish junior squad when I was 14 years old, and worked my way through, raced for GB as a junior and then subsequently as a senior as well. So that was my first sort of international sport. And then I switched across into fell running stroke hill running when, as an impatient youngster, I wasn't breaking through into the senior world championships team for orienteering straight away, and had already been experimenting with a few hill running events, and so decided I'd pursue that for a period of time at least, and fell into some success quite quickly as a hill runner, and actually never went back to orienteering. So then I was a hill runner. I'd moved down to Leeds by this point and studied a year at University of Leeds, and was able to access all the sort of fell races across the north of England. Still representing Scotland, so I did 7 World Cups representing Scotland as a hill runner, and I started racing abroad as well. So I started going out to Europe, and was a full-time runner for the summer each year, doing the mountain races throughout the Alps.
So I guess there wasn't a great deal of money in those sports at that time. So how, when you said you were a full-time runner, how did you make ends meet?
Yeah, well, I certainly wasn't strictly speaking a professional. I was, I guess, semi-pro, you'd probably say, that most of the year I worked 4 days a week in various jobs, such as managing a running store in Halifax for quite a few years, and then one in Leeds as well, up and running, one of the first up and running shops.
So that's the one that's still there now in West Park?
Yes, it is. That's right. Yeah. So I was more or less the first manager of that, and managed that for a number of years at the point when the company only had basically a couple of shops, the one in Harrogate, the original one, and the one in Leeds.
And if I'm always recommending
that people go to see Louisa, one of our friends at the Coach House. And if anybody does go to the Coach House Physio Clinic, all you've got to do is pop over the road and you're straight into up and running, really.
That's right. Still there now. And, you know, I've always I really enjoyed working in those running shops and dealing with other runners and all that type of thing. And I'd very fortunately had employers who were very flexible with me, allowed me to go and race at weekends, allowed me to maybe take a 2 or 3 month break in the summer and go to Europe and race there. So, you know, it suited me very well.
I just wanted to pick up on something. When you moved to Leeds, you lived in a house that spawned an athletics club, I think. Is that right? Was it DOS AC?
No, not exactly. No, DOS AC existed prior to me moving to Leeds. Probably one of the reasons I did move here, in fact, was the presence of a strong orienteering club around the university and also a strong running club, which was University of Leeds cross-country club, but also DOS AC, which is their sort of past and present incarnation. So I'd even actually been to a hot week in the Lake District with the Dossers prior to moving to Leeds.
And did a lot of them live in the same house? Am I right in thinking that?
Well, at one point, I mean, I shared houses with other runners, as you would do. And at one point, I lived in a house that had through its doors quite a number of illustrious runners.
Yeah, who would that? Go on, give us some of the names then.
So people like Greg Hull, Anne Buckley, Martin Roscoe, Helen Purdy, who was a very good long-distance triathlete. Obviously myself, and yeah, quite a number of other people as well.
Wow. So it's funny how these little nucleuses of athletes sort of come together. You hear stories about this from all over the world, don't you? So you talked about being in Europe, spending summers in Europe. You had some success racing in Switzerland, I think, didn't you?
Yes, I did. I mean, I was quite fortunate. The first time I went over to Europe, I did about 3 races. And the third one was Sierra Zinal, which is the sort of most prestigious mountain race in Europe. And I hit a really good vein of form just around that time. And up to that point, the only British person who'd won it was Jeff Norman. So Jeff, very well-known fell runner and Olympian. He ran marathon for Great Britain in the Olympics, and he still runs nowadays. And it was one of my sort of heroes, I suppose, because he'd done that. And I was really fortunate, and I managed to sneak a win in that race. I won by 17 seconds, I think. It's about a 2.5 hour race. So,
and is that an up and down or just an up?
It's more up than down, but there's downhill as well. So you start in the valley down in Sierra, and there's a couple of 1,000 meter climb. Takes you up above 2,000 meters of altitude, and then you contour along the side of the side valley for quite a lengthy period, and then it drops down into Zinal at the end. So there is a descent towards the end, and it was on that I managed to snatch my win, because I had a little bit more downhill experience than some of the continental guys.
Yeah, am I right in thinking that a lot of the European mountain races are really just go up and finish at the top? They don't do as much downhill as we might do in fell running in the UK.
It varies quite a bit from country to country. So that's true in Switzerland. There's a lot of uphill only races in Switzerland. But if you go to Italy, they have a lot of up and down races, and they're extremely good at running downhill. So when they come to the UK, they actually often do well, even on our more traditional courses.
Now, I remember Alistair Brownlee, because he joined a running club with a big fell running tradition at Bingley Harriers. And when he first did his WTS races before the 2008 Olympics, I think he was saying that how poor that the triathletes generally were at running downhill. Whereas from that fell running background, you learn to relax and just let your body go and run downhill fast.
Yeah, that's very true, actually. I remember when Alistair was a junior, there were a few of those races where he was able to take advantage of that and make more time on the downhills than on the climbs. I think triathletes did get a bit better at running generally and at downhill after that. But yeah, he definitely made use of that.
But I remember right at the very beginning when Alistair was in the little north of England squad that you and I used to look after, he went off to do a triathlon event for British Triathlon, probably youth relays, and then stayed in Europe to do the European mountain event as well, didn't he? So he sort of, his his allegiances were split between two sports.
Yeah,
at that
time. He did race one or two of those. I think he did a World Cup as well for mountain running. So yeah, he did do both.
Yeah, and you still see him at some of the fell races around Yorkshire as well, don't you? You
know, yeah, like, he likes to do the local races.
On Lang Syne on New Year's Eve.
Yeah, when he has the opportunity, yeah.
Yes. Okay. So fell running, mountain running, if you like. How and at what point did you get into triathlon then?
So I got into triathlon in 1986 when I was working in New Zealand. I'd gone there for the winter and was making orienteering maps, which again was another of these jobs that allowed me to get plenty of training in. And a guy that I was working for in Taupo was also, as well as being in charge of the orienteering club, also organized the Taupo triathlon. And I was cycling to get to the forest that I was mapping every day. I borrowed his son's bike, I think. And he said, why don't you do the triathlon? You can swim. Or he asked me, and I said I'd swum a little bit when I was a youngster. And so I started going along to swim with him and his son in the mornings at the AC baths there. And a few months later, I did the Taupo triathlon, and I entered a couple of other ones as well because I always liked to race. I thought, well, I've done the training, might as well enter them. So I did three races while I was on that trip, including the New Zealand Championships, and then came back to Europe. And I didn't really think too much of it because I was really just a mountain racer. But I think I probably did start to put a little bit of swimming into my training just then. And then the following year, when I was out racing in Europe, I had a free weekend. I was done a race called Annecy-le-Semnoz in the French Alps. And at the after party, somebody pointed out to me that it was the Annecy Triathlon the next weekend. I didn't have a race the next weekend. I also didn't have a bike or any swimming gear or anything with me. But I got persuaded that somebody in the local bike shop lent me a bike. So I did that race. And that was the only race I did that year, which was 1987, I think. And so subsequently, I got a little bit of a flavour for it. I did reasonably well in the races that I did, and started doing some of the British races as well alongside my hill running.
Now, it's quite hilly on certain sides of Lake Annecy there, isn't it? Was there any hill running in that, or was it all alongside the lake?
It was all alongside the lake, yeah. I think the bike was a lap of the lake. Of course, I was a much better runner than anything else in those days. So I was always coming from behind. And rather bizarre thing in that race was I was running along and people were starting to shout at me that I was in second place. But I was 2 minutes or something ridiculous behind the guy who was winning. I went across the line. The guy who won it turned out to be a Kiwi that I'd had a race against in one of the three previous races I'd done and finished just behind him too.
Anybody that was famous at that time, if there was any famous Kiwi triathletes in the late 80s?
Well, there were some famous athletes. I think that in that one of those races that I did, that Alison Rowe, the marathon runner, was racing in the women's event. I think she did a few triathlons. Yeah. I seem to remember that. It was the era, I guess, of people like Rick Wells and Aaron Baker.
He was the name that came to mind, yeah, Rick Wells, because he went on, I think he finished second in the World Championships, didn't he? 1 year, famous sprint finish with two others.
Yes, I was actually at that race, the 91 Worlds in the Gold Coast. I'm just trying to think.
Was it Mike Pigg? Some Australian lad with blonde hair.
Yes.
Somebody's son.
That's right, yeah.
I can't think. It was probably called Scott or something, because every good triathlete in those days was called Scott.
Nah, I should absolutely remember that, but it's just escaping me at the moment.
We'll remember it before the end, yeah. No doubt. But, okay, so you sort of fell into triathlon by chance, just through, you know, just what you did as a way of keeping fit and getting around. Just before we move on, we were talking about some of the fell runners and how they, you know, how they have a very relaxed attitude to training and racing. It's not quite as structured as triathletes. They tend to spend a lot more time in the pub than your average triathlete would, and they tend to keep fit for running by cycling between events. The guys I know cycle to fell races, do the race, have a pint, and then cycle back. You were telling me that you, when you first started, you just used to get everywhere on foot.
Yeah, I definitely did. As a student, I used to run everywhere. That was my main mode of transport. I did use my bike a bit as well, but I was probably for shorter sort of traveling around town. I would tend to just run.
And just running at an easy pace, trotting really.
Shuffling. Yeah, basically, yeah.
So we talked about this polarized training has become very popular again, but actually it's not a new thing, is it? And if you look back at the sort of stuff that Arthur Lydiard probably used to do back in the 60s, you're almost describing a polarized training thing there, where you trot around for 90% of the time. And I guess your high intensity stuff would be a track session if you went to one, or a weekend race.
Yeah, I mean, my probably most successful periods as a runner, I was mainly either running steady or racing.
Yeah.
So I did a few years. So I raced an incredible amount, so like 100 plus races per year.
Wow. So that's two a week then.
So on average, two a week. Yes. Yeah.
So you don't really need to do any track sessions or anything if you're doing that sort of stuff, do you?
No, I mean, at one point when I was doing my teacher training, I would run 5 miles to the school I was teaching and 5 miles back again in the evening.
Yeah,
and that was training, and Wednesday afternoons a race or an evening races during the summer, and I'd race once or twice at the weekend.
And what sort of, were they all fell races or cross country?
They were absolutely everything, really. So track races, cross country, fell, road, orienteering occasionally still at that point. Yeah, all sorts of things.
And did you have much of a structured training plan there, or was it just run everywhere and then a couple of races?
Well, it was structured. I did plan things out, so it wasn't completely random. And I've always kept a detailed training diary. For some reason, that's a big motivator for me. So I've got diaries going all the way back to 1986. I go back. Yes, I still got those.
Yeah. Wow, that'd be an interesting book, Jack's training diaries.
I've got 25 years. It'll be a little bit like Ron Hill's Long Hard Read. That'll be what my training diaries would be like. Yeah.
And would it be a long hard read? Today I ran to school and back. Yeah, and I guess, you know, we talk about, a lot of people talk about speed running and not having enough speed. But speed to me, it's not about running fast over a couple of miles. It's about getting the legs turning quickly over short periods of time. Fell running would be the perfect opportunity to develop leg speed, wouldn't it, on the way downhill? Because if you don't keep your legs going fast, you fall over.
That's true, but you also need a tremendous amount of leg strength.
Yes.
So I think your fell runners are usually very strong in a similar way that you need to be for cycling. So you often see quite a good correlation between cycling ability and fell running ability.
Well, I've cycled with some of your fell running colleagues of the past, Ian Ferguson and Andy Peace and Ian Holmes, and they are very, very strong cyclists. I can't keep up with them. They're also a lot lighter than me as well. But it's not that they have cycle trained to develop that strength. It just seems to come from the fell running.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I mean, you see, fell runners have done very well in moving across into straight road running. And we mentioned Jeff Norman earlier, who went to the Olympics, but there were people like Kenny Stewart, John Wilde, the contemporaries of mine that I raced many, many times, really class athletes. And, you know, they showed it across all sorts of types of running.
Yeah.
Kenny ran, I think, a 2:11 marathon, something like that, after he moved on from fell running.
Well, and just on a topical note, I guess it shows the quality of some of the performances people you used to race against, because Billy Bland's Bob Graham round record, which was set in 1982, has only just been broken by somebody as just a world superstar as Kilian Jornet, who's just about broken every record. So how many years is that? That's 36 years.
Yeah,
that record stood.
Absolutely. And if you look back at some of the sort of classic records for races like Snowdon and Ben Nevis, then they still stand from that same era.
Right. Who was the Ben Nevis record then? Was that Kenny Stewart?
I think it is Kenny's, yeah. There's Kenny and John Wilde have both run very fast times there. I came second behind Kenny one year when he broke the record.
Did you break the record as well?
I think I did break the old record. Obviously, that doesn't count.
There is a guy, I think, that's competing now that I saw on the TV the other day that's come close to breaking that record. I'm not sure of his name. Scottish guy. But he was on, I think he might have been on Countryfile, actually, but they were talking about how close he was to breaking the record. But
yeah, I mean, so of course, you know, records are there to be broken, aren't they? And it's funny how some stand and some don't. And sometimes it is just an anomaly. I had the Pendle Hill race record for very many, many years, and it's got removed from the books recently. And I'm fairly sure that they changed the course some time ago. So the people have been racing my record, but on a different course. But another race is, you know, it's to the top of the mountain and back again. So the course can't have changed that much. And some have stood the test of time. Another events that I was part of, and I thought that record will stand forever, and it got broken a few years later. So yeah. I just don't know.
Okay, back to triathlon then. So you've started racing triathlon, you've been abroad, you've done some races. Did you represent Scotland at the Commonwealths? I think triathlon was a test event, wasn't it? Back in, was it 88?
1990,
sorry.
Yeah, so that was probably the thing that inspired me to move into triathlon as my number one sport. I'd been playing around with it for a few years. And 1989, I went and raced the World Cup mountain running in D in France. And I knew that this test event was coming up of Commonwealth Games the following year, 1990. And there was a selection race in Scotland in about October time, I think it was. So I did the World Cup and mountain running in France, and then came back to Scotland and did the selection race and got myself in the team for the Commonwealth Games. And then I went off and raced the Everest Marathon in the interim period, came back to Britain very briefly and flew out to New Zealand, arrived there I think on Christmas Eve that year.
So the Everest Marathon, you actually had quite a bit of success in the Himalayas, didn't you? Because it wasn't just the Everest Marathon. I think I remember you did the triathlon. Was it the Annapurna Triathlon, they called it?
Yeah, that's right. So that started with the Everest Marathon, which I did that time in 1989. I think it was only the second time that race had been held.
And how did you get on there?
So I won that and set a record that stood until fairly recently, but has now been broken by a number of Nepalis. So I'm dropping down the all-time list there, but that's an event that's massively affected by the conditions. So for many years, you know, people were wading through knee-deep snow and they obviously weren't going to get near to the record times. But yes, I did that. And then one of the instigators of that race put on this race called Annapurna Triathlon and invited me to come and do that the following year. But that was where it kind of clashed with, I think it clashed with me going to the back to do the Mount Cameroon race, actually. There was some reason I couldn't do it that first time, but then I went to the second and subsequent editions for about 6 years, I think.
Yeah, and you won those, despite many attempts to try to beat you, I think.
I won all but one of them. I got snookered in the final one that I did when I double punctured.
One of those things. And it was, I guess it was mountain bike cycling, was it?
It was mountain bike or cyclocross bike. And I used both. It was a little bit debatable which was better. The year that I punctured, I was on my cross bike. So maybe it wasn't a good choice. I don't know.
Okay. And we'll come back to Nepal in a minute. But let's just go back to Commonwealth Games then. So the 1990 Games, was that? Where was that?
Auckland.
Okay, so how did you get on in that race and who were your main competitors there?
Well, I wasn't troubling the front of the field, to be honest. I suppose my main competitors I saw as the other British athletes. And there was a little bit of rivalry between, obviously, the Scots, Welsh, English and Irish. And my end up in that was that I came the first Scot behind one person from each of the other countries.
And who were, because I had Ian Hamilton on the show last week, and Ian was racing much younger than you, but in that same era around the late 80s, early 90s, and we were talking about some of the the big names in triathlon at that point. So who would have been in the England team then? Glenn Cook?
Yeah, I kind of have to struggle a little bit to remember now. Was Glenn in that team? I don't think he was, no, because I think it was a non-financed event. You had to pay your own way. So that did mean that a lot of the professional athletes chose not to go. But Sarah Springman was there in the English team, for example. And you know, there were definitely some very good athletes. I think Ken McLaren definitely beat me. He was representing Wales.
And he's settled in New Zealand now. Lives out there, doesn't he?
He does. Yeah.
Does he live in Taupo?
No, he lives in Napier.
Okay. Yeah.
And Rick Wells was the winner of the men's race, and I think Aaron Baker the winner of the women's race. So they were, you know, also went on to be world champions and did very well across the whole sphere of triathlon.
Yeah,
at the time.
I'm not sure if Erin Baker isn't getting nominated for the Ironman Hall of Fame this year, but she went on to be a very good Ironman triathlete.
She did,
she?
Yeah.
She was married to Scott Molina for a while, I think.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Okay, so you, but this was before the era that most people that are listening to this will be familiar with, the Brownlee era. So Ian and I were talking last week, we were discussing people like Spencer Smith, Simon Lessing. There were a lot of people haven't heard of, but were absolute legends and world champions before the Brownlees dominated the sport. I mean, Lessing had a domination that was probably as good as Alistair Brownlee's back in his era. And then on to Spencer Smith as well.
Yeah, no, those are the guys that I was, you know, competing against in a way. Like I said, I'd probably never beat either of those unless they had a major problem, which occasionally they did. But I was on teams with both of those guys, and yeah, they were absolutely the best in the world at the time.
I must get Spencer on. I'm sure he'd have a few stories to tell.
I think he would, definitely.
Yeah, okay, so early 90s then. How long did you compete as a full-time triathlete before you decided to hang up your... what do you hang up as a triathlete? Hang up your wetsuit, I suppose.
yeah, well, I competed through to 2002. So I had a go at getting back into the Commonwealth Games in 2002 in Manchester, which was actually the next time the sport was in the Commonwealth Games, and it was fully in that time. But I didn't succeed. And one of the reasons that I didn't succeed, I felt, was that I'd started to get quite heavily into coaching by then. And I was working with yourself and the British juniors, and so trying to balance coaching them and doing my own training was a step too far, and I overcooked myself a bit and wasn't in my best form going into the selection races.
Yeah, so that would be another interesting conversation to have, because probably you and I both know examples of full-time athletes these days who are running a coaching business on the side to fund them. But it's always made me think about how much that affects their racing, or how much it affects their ability to deliver fully to the people they're coaching when they're, you know, if you're in a position to podium at an Ironman or a 70.3 or something, and you're having to think about athletes, do you then ignore them while you're concentrating on your racing? And how would you feel if you were one of those people who was paying your coach who didn't then focus on you for a few weeks?
Yeah, it's difficult to say. There's pros and cons, and you know, just because I got it wrong doesn't mean it's not possible to get it right. And I think, you know, with the experience I've got nowadays, I could have managed that much better.
Yeah,
I was literally trying to do both things. So you're on a training camp, and you would get up early to do an hour of swimming before coaching for an hour, and then, you know, grab a quick breakfast before going out riding with athletes, and then trying to fit your own track session in mid-afternoon before coaching their session, that type of thing. And it just wasn't smart.
Did you find it an easy transition from racing to coaching and to coaching full-time then? Or did you find it difficult mentally to cope with not being able to race anymore, seeing as you've been doing that for so long?
Yeah, I didn't actually find it so difficult giving up the racing, to be quite honest. I think that aspect of it was fine, probably because I ended up a little bit burnt out right at the end, and I felt I had my I'd done what I was capable of doing as an athlete. So it was coming to a natural sort of end anyway. I was 40 years old, and I wasn't going to be surpassing my results from previously. I didn't feel best I could hope for was maybe just about keeping up with the ongoing improvements in standards. So I felt fairly fulfilled as an athlete, and it was really nice to be still involved with the scene and to be able to go to races and feel excited on behalf of an athlete. So I would get at least as nervous watching some of my athletes racing as I used to do racing myself.
Now, the High Performance Centre in Leeds was started in 2005, is that right? Or 2006?
Actually 2004.
Okay. Yeah. But before then, there was a nationwide talent ID programme that British Triathlon were supporting, and there was already a group running in the north of England, wasn't there? It wasn't a Yorkshire-based one, it was a north of England-based one, is that right?
Well, we started that up, and I think it was 2001, so post-Sydney Olympics. There'd been no sort of formal junior program prior to that, but it was set up. It's called the World Class Start and Potential Program. It's basically a talent identification and development program. And I was already working with you a little bit because you'd asked me to help you with some private coaching. And we sort of bid for that northern part of that program and started running that towards the end of 2001, I think. So mm-hmm. It was partly because I had that little bit of work and doing the private coaching with yourself that I was able to, in January 2002, give up working in the running shop and be a full-time coach.
Okay, so the remit, if you like, of that Start and Potential Talent ID program was to find athletes that might compete for Great Britain at a higher level and, I suppose, ultimately win medals. There were quite a few good athletes that came out of that. I guess the ones that most people would know are probably the Brownlees and Phil Graves.
Yes, that's right. But yeah, a number of other people as well, yeah.
Yeah, and from there, then it was a natural step for the Leeds High Performance Centre to sort of be started, I guess, with a sort of more formalised base.
Yeah, I will remember that you and I sat down and we did a bit of sort of medium to long-term planning. And one of the things that we kind of identified that we'd like to see would be a performance centre in the north. We had all those young athletes and they were nearly all leaving the north and going to either Loughborough or to Bath, the majority to Loughborough, but we had at least one athlete who went to Bath because those were only sort of universities which provided a coach triathlon programme. So we saw the opportunity to do that in Leeds with the help of Graham Moore, the performance director, and also Malcolm Brown, who very fortuitously became the director of sport at Leeds Met University at almost exactly the right time. We were able to get that to happen.
So, I mean, again, the whole Leeds High Performance Centre story could be a podcast in itself. It's been tremendously successful and contributed to the majority of Great Britain's medals right up to the Olympics recently, hasn't it? I think in the last Olympics, five of the six team members were from Leeds.
Yeah, that's right.
So most people would obviously know that the Brownlees, but then in more recently we've had Jessica Learmonth, and who else have we had from Leeds then?
Well, there's Vicky Holland and Non Stanford that were at the Olympics, yeah. and Gordon Benson was the third member of the British men's team at the Olympics. Richard Vargo represented Slovakia and had been training with us for the previous few years as well. So we had six athletes altogether there. And there's people recently like Georgia Taylor Brown. She moved to Leeds when she was coming to university, as did Tom Bishop. And both of those guys have podiumed at World Series level as athletes in recent years.
Yeah, and of course now we've got the new wave coming through as well. I mean, Alex Yee's been in the headlines recently for running that incredibly fast 5K last week, and is he British 10K champion on the 10,000 metre champion on the track as well?
He is, that's right. And the previous year we had Beth Potter, who was the British 10K champion as well.
Yeah.
And she's been training in Leeds since before then.
So we've got Alex, we've got Sam Dickinson as well. And is it Kate Roberts?
Kate Wolf.
Kate Wolf, yeah. And then we've got Sian Rounsley as well.
Yes.
So there's an enormous pool of talent in Leeds that are just waiting to break through into the big time, really. So let's just talk briefly about how going from a standing start, pretty much, back in 2005, how did we get to this point in 2016 where Leeds was almost the dominant triathlon centre in the world for standard Olympic distance racing?
Well, it was a lot of different factors, I think, but undoubtedly the success of Alistair and Johnny it was a major one, and Alistair choosing to remain in Leeds and train here was probably the single most important thing, as it turned out. But the fact is that he was able to be supported by all sorts of different people and different institutions, allowed him to stay here throughout all that time and get as good as he's got.
Yeah, because when you started, I guess it would have been you, Malcolm. Did you have some sort of part-time support from Alison Rose? Because she was working as a physio up at the university, but she was really working with other athletes and just happened to be here because Malcolm had invited her to be here.
Yes. So, I mean, Malcolm wasn't really involved as a coach straight away. I mean, he'd come as a running coach, and I didn't know him, but I knew a little bit all about him because he'd been the UK endurance coach at the Sydney Olympics, and he was doing a bit of coaching. You know, it wasn't his job. He was an amateur coach, very professional, but amateur because his job was running the university department of sport. So, but he did become involved through an approach from Alistair to help him with his running, and over time became more and more involved.
How many support staff would you say are in the team now in Leeds?
Well, there's probably at least 10.
Yeah, so, I mean, I guess that shows that firstly, that elite athletes, they're the ones that cross the line. They're the ones we see getting the medals put around the necks. But actually, we all know that there's a support team behind them that makes all that happen. So you've gone from a cobbled together support team of getting people that you knew probably when you needed them to people are now here to support this growing number of athletes. But as a coach then, you know, your coaching style at that point, because you've got two or three athletes that you're coaching directly, but then you've got these other athletes that are coming into the centre. So you're trying to create a program for a centre as well. So you've got two different jobs there. How do you manage that? Was it directive, or did you just sort of set out a structure and allow people to develop themselves within that?
Yeah, well, the program did evolve, you know, significantly over that period of time. So from 2004 until last year, we went from one squad of maybe 10 or 12 athletes of all standards. So literally from Alistair in one lane to a member of staff who could barely swim a length of front crawl in the far lane. And that was the sort of setup that we had. We did get some help from TAS, Talented Athlete Support Scheme, which meant that we had four athletes that were on some sort of support from them, and that helped us to start to use some other support staff. But it was very, very small beginnings. And last year when I left, we had four squads, 72 athletes, four full-time coaches, a number of part-time coaches, and then, you know, a lot of support staff working around that, as we alluded to there. So it increased, and it increased for a number of reasons. It increased sometimes because it needed to. So in order to get access to the facilities and support that we needed, we sometimes had to broaden the scope of who we were dealing with. And it also partly because of demand. So triathlon's become a much more popular sport over the years. So it's back in the beginning, you would get people coming along and joining the squad who didn't own a bike and never done any road cycling. Whereas nowadays we get people coming who've been racing as triathletes from a young age, done multiple races, been in regional academies, all that type of thing. So it's a completely different sort of demographic that you're dealing with.
Yeah, we had Sam Dickinson on recently, and he was talking about how he'd started and he'd been a triathlete since he was about 13 or 14. So, you know, as you said, back in your era, people happened into triathlon because they were wanting to try something different, or maybe they were injured and they couldn't run as much. So cycling and swimming helped take off some of the load there. But now, as you say, a lot of them are coming through. They start out as triathletes, or maybe they're in the school running and swimming squad, and it's a natural extension to get on a bike and try their hand at triathlon.
Yeah, I think it's definitely still extremely important that people are training in these single sport clubs as well. I mean, I think that's essential in terms of getting good quality elite athletes through in the future. But people have got that opportunity to do triathlon from a young age as well, and that definitely helps too.
I don't know if you can remember, but there's a story that I've told a couple of times. In that original squad that we had back in the early 2000s, there was a young lad from the Yorkshire area called Scott Thwaites, if you remember.
Yes.
And Scott's dad was constantly badgering us to get Scott onto the programme. And Scott was an exceptionally good cyclist, but he wasn't quite as good at swimming and running. And Scott's dad kept telling us that Scott was better than Alistair Brownlee and Johnny Brownlee on the bike. And we kept saying, but it's all about the swim and the run days. And we sent him off to British Cycling, I seem to remember, giving him the contact for Shane Sutton. And of course, Scott Thwaites is now a Dimension Data professional cyclist racing on the World Tour. And Alistair and Johnny are Olympic medalists. So that that Talent ID programme back, you know, nearly 20 years ago of identifying talented swimmers and runners will probably still hold fast today, I would say.
Yeah, I think we actually got quite a lot of things right, certainly with the information we had available at the time. But as I said, you know, things did change a lot over that period of time as well. And you talked about the sort of coaching style, and a lot of, you know, what I did, I probably learned from my own time going through various squads. So I was in the, you know, the Scottish Junior Orienteering Squad we mentioned a long time ago, and I got some really good ideas and inspiration from the sort of things that they did there. And I learned what motivated me, and I guess I thought, you know, that could work for other people, youngsters of a similar age. And I had quite a lot of experience of being my own coach. The whole time I was hill running, I was my own coach. I didn't have a coach. But then I realized as a coach that, you know, athletes can and should do a lot of things for themselves. So all of those things molded the way that I dealt with athletes along the way.
So, and you would call that a non-interventionist style of coaching, almost allowing athletes to find their own way and then being on hand maybe to give them guidance and advice if they need it.
Yeah, it's very difficult to, I think it's very difficult to really be too black and white about it, because I think there's always different ways you can handle any given situation. And sometimes you do need to intervene and give advice or be proactive and do things, but other times you don't, and it's just getting that balance right. And what I've discovered a lot of the time is being less interventionist, although it can feel quite hard to do, often turns out to get the result that you want, or that you know, that gets the best result. It may not even be a result that you can predict. So, but it is tricky, and it's tricky to explain to people, and it's tricky to convince people. And at the end of the day, it probably comes down a lot to the individual and their ability to do that.
But then that is all about understanding the athlete, isn't it? Getting inside the head, knowing what they're like. Because I've experienced as well, probably like you have, that there are some people who can work it out for themselves and are quite self-sufficient, can get on with it and just need a bit of guidance every now and again and a bit of reassurance that they're on the right track. And there are other people who need permission to do everything, you know, to cut a run short, to change the session around, you know, do you mind, it's a nice day today, is it okay if I go out cycling? And they seem to have the okay from somebody rather than working it out for themselves.
Yeah, and I think you could definitely say as a general principle that you want to take that latter type of athlete and get them to be more independent, really, to make more decisions for themselves, because making good decisions is a really important part of becoming the best athlete you can be. And the athlete is often better placed than anybody else to make those decisions if only they will listen to themselves, have confidence and do it.
Well, decision-making is a skill in itself, isn't it? And I remember listening to Craig Alexander talking about in Hawaii one year about who was going to win the race the next day. He was probably being interviewed in a press conference. And he said, well, look, there's 15 guys here who are probably capable of winning tomorrow, but there's only four or five of them going to be in the shout. And then so he said, well, what's going to make the difference? And he said, decision-making about, you know, do you go with that break or don't you? Do you go hard early or do you have courage and hold on to the end? But he said there will be four or five guys who make the right decisions and the rest of them will make the wrong decision, even though they're capable of winning. And those decisions that they make will be born out of experience in previous races, wouldn't they, and making mistakes previously.
Yeah, that's right. And you can definitely help people to become better at decision-making by the types of training they do, for example. So, and the type of ways that that training is presented to them, and all those sorts of things. So if you have that as one of the goals that you want to promote as a coach, then there are ways of helping the athlete to get there.
Before we finish, Jack, I want to rewind a bit, because we talked a little about the time you spent in Nepal. Now, I know that having finished your time at Leeds High Performance Centre, you are looking to move into a slightly different sphere now, connected with yoga and that more holistic sort of form of lifestyle development, if you like, as well as sports development. But I wanted to explore how you got into yoga in the first place. And I've got a feeling that it started when you were out in the Himalayas.
Yes, it did. I mean, when I went to do the Everest Marathon, I spent about 10 weeks in Nepal because I needed to get thoroughly acclimatized, I felt, for that race. And I wanted to take the opportunity to see the country as well, of course. And I really loved it. I've always been interested in the mountains and had a sort of felt a bit of a draw towards them. So, but what I did find there as well was a completely different culture that I'd never been exposed to before. So when I came back to the UK afterwards, I thought I'd like to find something which would give me a little bit of a connection with that. And I came up with probably not a very original idea of maybe going to some yoga classes. So like most athletes, I associated those with flexibility and didn't feel that was an area of my training that I perhaps paid enough attention to. So I found a yoga class in Leeds and started going along to that at about that time. And it complemented my training for the rest of my career. And gradually, I got more and more into it. So the time that I retired from triathlon as an athlete, the thing that I wanted to spend more time doing was my yoga practice. So that, in a way, replaced training for me. It was another reason that I perhaps didn't miss being a triathlete quite so much, because I had something else to spend my time on, writing my training diary. And I guess yoga in its holistic sense, not just flexibility, has changed me a lot as a person and informed the way that I go about my coaching and hopefully a lot of my life. So I'm now looking to take up the opportunity to make much more use of that within my coaching, because I did try to bring it in when I was working in the high performance sphere. But there were a number of difficulties in doing that. One being that I didn't have the expertise myself, really, to teach it to the level that I needed. And I went down the route of training as a yoga teacher, but that really wasn't sufficient because I didn't have that experience of teaching. But my partner, Kirsten Stephenson, she's a very experienced yoga teacher, and she's been able to take up that part of the project. And I started working with a number of my athletes, and I've been doing it for quite a few years now. But moving forwards, I want to really integrate the two and have yoga and triathlon alongside each other.
So you said that you thought that it might help you become a bit more flexible. Do you think that's a real benefit from yoga? Because I've started, you tried to persuade me for years that yoga would be a good addition to my, I call it daily practice rather than my workouts. And I have, in the last few months, started a weekly yoga class. In fact, I'll be heading off there in a couple of hours. And I've found it to be much more than just increased flexibility.
Yeah, of course, it is much more than just increased flexibility. I mean, it certainly can lead to increased flexibility, doing a regular yoga practice. That's probably not necessarily a major aim if you're working with athletes, and certainly not with high performance athletes who might already be quite well conditioned and quite well balanced, and they don't want to get too flexible. You know, there's a kind of sweet spot to get to, but they don't need to worry about that either, because if they're doing it alongside lots of repetitive training, then all it's going to do is maintain their body in the state that it is in, as far as the flexibility is concerned. So yeah, it's about much more than the flexibility. But of course, I've become much more flexible because I started as a pretty inflexible runner who could touch my toes with a bit of contortionism. You know, And with quite a bit of work and a lot of stiffness in my hamstrings over the years, I've now got a reasonable forward fold.
Yeah, but how's your running?
My running, it's probably not so good, but I'm probably, you know, I'm probably stronger in a number of areas. I can get into a much better position in my bike than I used to be able to. I've got much better core strength. So a lot of physical aspects I'm better in. I'm probably much better physiologically as well. I'm healthier. But as I say, it's actually probably beyond that into the sort of mental sphere that the greatest benefits are.
I found one of the big benefits to be on breathing, to learning to breathe into my stomach. And interestingly, if you watch the Tour de France and you see these guys bent over the handlebars and you look at them and think, oh, he's got a bit of a belly, you know, when they breathe. But actually, if you look closely, you'll see that they're breathing into their stomach and it's the lungs that are expanding down. It's the diaphragmic expansion and using the bottom two thirds of the lungs to breathe and therefore get a better sort of oxygen circulation and probably a more efficient system. And that's something that I've noticed has had an impact on my swimming and an impact on my cycling as well. So that is a performance benefit that you wouldn't normally think of.
No, it's absolutely at the root of yoga. It's probably the single biggest difference from other forms of exercise is that the attention to the breath is paramount. And, you know, that's the root of a lot of the benefits.
And of course, if you're going to a yoga class for an hour, switch off your phone. There's no external disturbances other than the voice of the instructor guiding you through the movements. So you're totally focused on that. I can never remember the name of that last little bit when you lie down and you're not supposed to go to sleep, but that's what happens to me. But it seems that indicates full relaxation in that last couple of minutes. I quite often start drifting off.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, you know, a lot of the yoga teachers will just say, take rest. You know, it's as simple as that. It doesn't need to have a fancy name, but it's amazing how few people actually take the time to really switch off and relax properly and during the normal day. And you have to have that in combination with the work that's done beforehand and the breathing that's gone beforehand that makes it particularly powerful. So it's not as simple as just lying down and not doing anything.
And this is going to be your next project, helping triathletes and maybe other multi-sport athletes to integrate alongside the energetic part of their training, the swim, bike and run, the strength training, with the more relaxing meditation, yoga positions, and all of that sort of holistic aspect that goes with it to try and help them to become a better overall athlete. And probably it's something that we should get you and Kirsten, who you mentioned, your partner, back onto the show to do part two and talk about exactly how it's going to be possible for energetic athletes to integrate this sort of slowing down into their lifestyle.
Yeah, no, I think that would be very interesting. I mean, it's a big subject, but it's a very interesting one. And I think, you know, taking from that premise of yoga almost being the first thing you put into a program, why would you do that? And why would that be a benefit to people, not just in their triathlon, but maybe in the lives more generally?
Absolutely. So Jack Maitland, fell runner to holistic practitioner via triathlon performance, triathlon coaching, high performance, Olympic gold medal creator or winning coach. Thank you very much for being on the show today. Listeners, I hope you've enjoyed it. How do any of our listeners get in touch with you, Jack, at the moment? Because I know you're having a new site built.
Yeah, so the best thing would be just to email me, jack@thetriathloncoach.com. And if you've got any questions or you're interested in being coached with a bit of yoga in there, then by all means, get in touch.
All right. So that wraps it up for today's show. I promise that we will bring Jack and Kirsten back very soon to talk about this whole wider nature of holistic triathlon coaching. But for now, thank you very much for listening. I do appreciate you joining us. I know that there are lots of podcasts out there that you could listen to. So it's really nice that you choose to listen to this one. If you are going to yoga this weekend or next week, have a relaxing time. I hope you get as much out of it as Jack and I do. But for now, thanks for listening and enjoy the rest of your week. Bye-bye.
That wraps up this week's episode. I'd just like to say thank you for taking the time to listen to the conversation today, and I hope you learned at least one thing that you can put into practice in your training. Now, if this was your first time listening, please go back and listen to our previous episodes. I can guarantee that they will be just as good as you heard from today's guest. If you've listened to all the episodes so far, then thank you so much for continuing this learning journey with me. As you might be aware, reviews and ratings are the currency of podcasts, so I would really appreciate it if you could leave a review and a rating on iTunes or Podbean. You could also follow me at the same time. I also have a free gift for you. In 30 years of competing in triathlon and 20 years of coaching, I've learned an awful lot from my own experiences and from some of the guests who have and will appear on this show. And I feel it's my duty, as I approach the latter stage of my coaching career, to share these with you. So I've put together 25 of my best training, racing and lifestyle strategies, and I've squeezed them down into just 2 pages of content. And in order to get hold of this, all you need to do is email triathlonsuccess to beth@thetriathloncoach.com, and she will send it right back out to you. You could also think about joining my Facebook community. It's called the Triathlon Coach Cafe. We've got over 2,300 members just like you, eager to find out more about how to improve their training and share their successes with people. It's free to join, but you will have to ask. So go along there, answer the questions, and then we'll even do a little video each week to answer your questions. Finally, if you want to make sure you don't miss future episodes, please subscribe using Podbean or iTunes. We release new episodes every Wednesday. So that's all for now. See you again next week, same time, same place.